Good afternoon. I'm Katie O'Toole from the College of Communications, and on behalf of the Penn State Forum and our sponsor, the Penn State Bookstore, welcome to all of you here today at the Nittany Lion Inn. And a special welcome to our guest, Justin Catanoso, and his niece who is joining him here today. And now to introduce today's guest, please welcome Penn State Provost Dr. Rod Erickson.
Thank you, Katie, and good afternoon. Well, it's always a pleasure to welcome a Penn Stater to this podium, and Justin Catanoso has a relationship with Penn State that goes back many years. His father and two older brothers were Penn State graduates, and Justin considered only Penn State when he applied to college. Justin majored in journalism and wrote for the Daily Collegian. His columns covered issues like legislative reapportionment, the Liquor Control Board and its state store system, and state budget cuts and the effect on Penn State's finances. Well, Justin, nothing has changed in the years that you've been gone, I'm sorry to say. After graduating with a bachelor's degree in journalism, Justin began work at the Center Daily Times, where he covered meetings of borough council, the planning commission, and similar groups. Eventually, his journalism career took him to other newspapers, to freelancing for Business Week, and to Wake Forest University for a Master of Arts in Liberal Studies. In 1998, Justin left daily newspapers to become executive editor of the Business Journal, a weekly business newspaper in North Carolina. He is also a visiting lecturer in journalism at Wake Forest University, teaching courses in reporting, writing, and editing. Justin wrote an investigative series into fraud in the American tobacco industry that took first place in public service in the North Carolina Press Association and was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize in public service. He has also won awards for his travel essays. He published his first book, My Cousin the Saint, in 2008. It's been praised as a nonfiction book that reads like a novel. One reviewer wrote, quote, "The author is a most talented and engaging writer, and he has quite a story to tell," unquote. The title of Justin's talk today is My Cousin the Saint, A Search for Faith, Family, and Miracles. Please welcome journalist, author, and proud Penn Stater, Justin Catanoso, to the Penn State Forum.
Good afternoon, everyone. I really did think there were only going to be about 10 people coming today, so I need to sort of scale this up. Before I get started, I just want to thank Tom Berner, who was my professor when I was here. He taught me all my reporting classes at Penn State, and he recommended me for this forum. Thank my my old classmate, Mike Poorman. We were on the Collegian together in the late 70s and early 80s, and he handled a lot of the logistics today. I'd like to thank Katie and Kathy for making all this come together and getting me here yesterday. And I'd like to offer a special thanks to a special person in my life, and that's Dr. John Nichols. He was my advisor at Penn State and an extraordinary influence on me as a young man. I met with him this morning for about an hour at the same time that the announcement went out that he was retiring after 35 years come this fall. So I would like to just say thank you, John, and thank you from Penn State to the scores and countless students that you have influenced over the years here. Well done. My book, the thing that brings me here to Penn State from North Carolina, is in many ways about homecomings. An American reconnecting with his Italian family and Italian heritage. And while there are a few places in the world that I love more than Italy, there is no place in the world that has been more important to determining who I've become than this campus and this university. I am extraordinarily honored to be here. I am really excited. I'm a little giddy. Think about it. I was a student here, wandering around here with all my dreams and all my aspirations and not knowing whether any of it would come true. And I get to come back to this campus not as a tourist, but as a guest. So thank you. Thank you for having me here today. When I think of my time here as a student, when I think of the impact that it had on me, I think that there were very few experiences that disappointed me. Except maybe the 1979 Sugar Bowl. I'm thinking, Joe, one play around the end, just one play. No, up the middle, every time. I know, I've come to grips with that in the last few years, but it's taken me a while. But I learned how to be a journalist here. When I was at the Collegiate, I swear I worked with some of the finest journalists in America, and we were kids learning how to apply that craft. I had wonderful professors whom I have tried to model in my own teachers. I took classes here that lit up my imagination, but none more important to me than an Italian Renaissance art history class taught by Eugenio Battisti, who was an Evan Pugh scholar at the time. But I'll tell you, though, I left here with far more than a top-notch education and life-shaping experiences and a diploma. I left here with a woman who would become my wife, Laurelyn Dossett, class of 1984, a psych major. That was the best deal of all. But I'm going to stop this sort of memory lane stuff, where I'm afraid I won't get to the point of why I was invited, which is my book, Homecomings, Miracles, and of course, my cousin, the saint, actually a saint. I want to tell you just a little bit about him and how this book came about before I share with you a story from the book. Gaetano Cattanoso was a second cousin of my grandfather. He was born in southern Italy in 1879 to a poor family in Calabria. He wasn't much of a worker. He was too weak to really be the farmer that his father hoped he would be. Instead, he entered the seminary at age 10. And what he did for the next 70 years was what the Catholic Church hailed as a life of heroic virtue. He became a priest in 1902. He had parishes in some of the poorest, most desperate places of southern Italy. He founded an order of nuns. He had a prison ministry, a hospital ministry. He taught in the seminary. He gave away everything he had. He modeled the life of Christ every day he lived. He was an extraordinary individual, a man of incredible integrity, incredible faith, through the worst of times in southern Italy. And here's the thing. You know, you'd think that we would have known something about that. The Cattanoso family in America has been in this country since 1902, 1903. We knew nothing about Gaetano Cattanoso. It happens with immigrants. They come here and they cut their ties. It really wasn't until about 10 years ago that I even knew that this priest existed. He died in 1963. And when I learned about him, he wasn't a saint yet. He had been beatified by Pope John Paul II. One miracle had already been attributed to him. My mother had sent me a little bit of information about him, and I read it in my home in Greensboro, North Carolina, and I set it aside because I said to myself, a Cattanoso, a saint? You have got to be kidding me. My cousins are from New Jersey. Billy, Anthony, Joseph, they could have been extras on the Jersey Shore. There are no saints in the Cattanoso family in America. And so I set it aside. How could I relate to this? I could not relate to it. And then a few months later, I got an email from a Giovanna Cattanoso from Reggio Calabria, the toe of the boot in Italy. And she had a simple question for me. I saw your name on the internet. I'm wondering if we're related. I didn't know what to say, so I attached a photograph of myself. I sent it to her. And she emailed back. She said, I showed your picture to everyone. There's no doubt. We are related. And after an exchange of emails, she sent me a letter. And she sent me this big family tree. It was sort of written on this oversized paper. And in it, I could see my family story back so much farther than I ever knew. Back generations, back centuries. And in it, I could see where we fit into this large, large family of Southern Italians. And down in the left-hand corner, there was this big family, and there was this name, Gaetano. And in parentheses, she had highlighted the saint. And I thought, there it is again. Who is this guy? Well, what happened after that is my wife and I planned to go back to Italy for the first time since our honeymoon in 1984. We took our daughters with us, and I write about this in the book. The reunion, the reception that we received just after Christmas in 2003 was extraordinary. It was an amazing weekend, and I started to learn about this family. I started to learn about Gaetano Cattanoso, and I came back, and I wrote a magazine story about having the saint in the family, reconnecting with these relatives, and placed it in a lot of places, including the Penn Stater. Tina Hay was kind enough to take that story. And then the story evolved, and it became different. It became much more personal. In 2004, my older brother, Alan, my niece, Marcella's father, was diagnosed with inoperable brain cancer. The only thing, really and truly, that was going to save Alan was a miracle. It just so happens that I had come back from Italy with knowledge of a holy man who Pope John Paul II said was capable of healing people miraculously. And we needed that. My mother woke up every morning to pray in Italian to this saint who we shared a name and a bloodline with. My brother Alan wore a medal of Gaetano around his neck. I wondered about the power of prayer in that moment, whether this made any difference. I wondered about that a lot. Alan died the week before Christmas in 2004. I wondered if any of our prayers had been heard. I was compelled to write an essay. I wrote this essay for National Public Radio. It was aired on Morning Edition, just a couple of days before the canonization, about 10 months after Alan died. And I thought I was done with this story. I put it in a magazine. I'd written about it in my own newspaper. I'd put it on National Public Radio. I thought that was pretty good. It was time to move on, do other things. But a literary agent was listening to NPR that morning in California, and believe it or not, those of you who have written books or have agents or have ever wanted to get an agent, I had one call me and say, I think you should write a book about this. I had plenty of reasons to say no. I'm a journalist. I know how to write. I tell other people's stories, though. And she convinced me that it was time to tell my own story. And she helped me get a book contract from HarperCollins, of all things. And that set me on this journey, the search for faith, family, and miracles. The research was very condensed, very intense. It was a little over a year. Research into Catholic Church history, the history of saints and sanctity, the technical process of the canonization. I went to Rome. I met with the Pope's saint makers. I mean, there's actually an office at the Vatican where there are guys that, like, vet saints. It's this amazing process. And then I went down into the toe of the boot. I went into the Calabria, and I lived among my relatives. I lived in the shadow of the legacy of this extraordinary individual, this man who would go on to join the communion of saints. And in the process of doing all this research, I learned about my family, which I didn't know anything about. My dad's not a storyteller. I learned family history. I accumulated family stories, stories I'd never heard before, stories that after a while left me feeling like the luckiest guy in the world to be a writer and have the opportunity to tell these stories. So this is one of those stories that I want to share with you. It was one that was told to me by my Uncle Tony, my dad's older brother, 65 years after the fact. It starts like this. What is a miracle? It is a phrase that we toss around with the ease and lightness of a frisbee. It's a miracle that I wasn't late for work today. It's a miracle that I passed that exam. It's a miracle that Penn State won the NIT last year. Okay, so maybe that one is a miracle. But the others, I don't think so. You see, these are not hypothetical questions to me, because when you have a cousin who's a saint, a Vatican-certified miracle worker, the technical definition of miracle takes on an outsized importance. And I know that definition because I have been to the Vatican and I have talked with these saint makers. They have explained to me what the definition is, and it's very precise, very arcane. But I'm here to tell you that there are Vatican miracles and there are family miracles. There are miracles that pull families together after they have been torn asunder by war and immigration. This is a story about my Uncle Tony, my 92-year-old Uncle Tony, the older brother of my father. And here's the thing. Uncle Tony doesn't care about Vatican definitions. What he says about this story is that it was a miracle, the first miracle performed by Padre Gaetano Cattanoso, who wasn't even a saint at the time. And in order to understand this story, I need to take just a step back and set it in a little bit of context. It's 1903, the port of Naples. The wharves are filled with Italians ready to flee that country. Now, I'm going to assume that a lot of you have been to Italy. You've been to Florence and Rome and Venice, and you know that it's a beautiful country. You know Italians are warm and generous and inviting. You can't wait to go back, and those of you who aren't Italian probably wish you were. But I want to tell you that a century ago, the regions south of Rome, Campania, Basilicata, Puglia, Calabria, Sicily, were terrible. They were poor and desperate, desolate and hopeless. And Italians left there by the millions. Between 1880 and 1920, in the great wave of American immigration, 4.5 million Italians left that incredible country, and 80% of them, 4 out of 5, were from the region south of Rome. And on that day in Naples, a March day in Naples, 1903, my grandfather, Carmelo Catanoso, 16 years old, holding everything he had in his arms and his birth ticket in his teeth, boarded a steamship, the Archimedes, away from his homeland to America, to break the ties with the people that he knew and loved the most, to become a newcomer to a new land, to leave the old world behind. For 3 weeks, he rode below deck across the Atlantic Ocean, tossing and tumbling until that great ship came into New York Harbor. And he came on deck, and what did he see? He saw the Statue of Liberty. Think about that. 16 years old. He took a deep breath, and he breathed freedom. He breathed freedom for the first time, and also for the first time, he could sense his own destiny, a destiny filled with dreams and promise and hope, things that were in dramatic short supply back in Calabria. Now, he managed to convince his brother, Giuseppe, to make the trip over a couple years later. He brought his parents over, too, but he could never convince his sister, Maria Porzia Catanoso, to come to America. She was married to Bruno, and Bruno liked it where they were, their little village of Corio, the same village the saint was born in. They had a tailor and barber shop, and they decided to stay back home in what really amounted to a third-world country, but not Carmelo, not my grandfather. He had ambition and drive. He wanted to seize his destiny. He settled in Philadelphia, and in 1913, he married another Italian, a Sicilian by the name of Caterina Foti, my grandmother. Together, they had 9 children. My father was in the middle, and Tony, remember, this is Tony's story, he was the third, the oldest son. These children were raised between 2 world wars that Italy picked the wrong side of both times. And when you were an Italian-American, between the world wars, it's not easy. You hate your curly hair. You hate your olive skin. You hate that your name ends in a vowel. You hate that your parents speak Italian to you in front of your friends. All you want to do is be like the other kids named Johnson or McDonald. You don't want to be a Catanoso because you hated being called a WOP and a Dago. And that's all you got called. Now, my Uncle Tony, he didn't take that stuff. He was a roughneck. He was a renegade. He fought back. He joined a gang when he was 10 years old. He smoked cigarettes. He got into knife fights, all of this in South Philadelphia where the family lived. And Carmelo, his father, sized this up and said, "No way. I did not come to America to raise a family full of hooligans." And so he relocated the family to the Jersey Shore, to North Wildwood, New Jersey, where he opened up the first Italian-American grocery. Now, that was not supposed to be a laugh line, folks. It was different then, in the 1920s. It's not different now, though. Good Lord. We are all immigrants. We all come from somewhere else. And some of you may know your family history. Some of you may know your family story, but mostly Italians and Italian Americans do not. They came to this country to prove themselves as Americans. They cut their ties with those relatives back home, even ties with someone as exalted as a priest that would go on to become a saint. They raised their families to become American. They looked in one direction and one direction only, and that was forward. My grandfather did that with his family. He had everything he needed with him right there in Cape May County. Carmelo died in 1941, February, suddenly of a heart attack. He was 53 years old. It was a total shock, unexpected. It threw the family off the rails. My father was a sophomore here at Penn State at the time in ROTC. They lost the family business. 9 months later, that same year, 1941, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and FDR gave up on his policy of neutrality. The U.S. entered the war. In time, all the Catanosa brothers would be drafted into the military. My Uncle Joe went to the Japanese theater. My Uncle Charlie went to the South Pacific. My father went into officer training in Louisiana and Texas, and Tony. Remember Tony? Tony should have been cannon fodder. Tony should have been an infantryman sent to the front lines in London or Paris. This was a guy who was thrown out of high school when he was a sophomore for hitting the shop teacher in the head with a block of wood. His father was summoned to the school that day and sat him down on the front steps and said, "Tony, what's it going to be? Because if you're not going to be a student, you're coming home to work." And Tony didn't hesitate. He said, "Pop, take me home." Now, Tony had some things in his favor. He was charming. He was handsome. He could speak Italian fluently. And you know who liked that? Dwight D. Eisenhower liked that. Not that he knew Tony. But Eisenhower's plan for winning the war for the Allies and defeating the Axis was to sweep up from the south, take Sicily, and use it as a staging ground for the rest of the continent. And in order to do that, he needed interpreters. He needed young Italian-Americans who looked the part and could play the part, and Tony was his man. Tony didn't carry a gun, but he was drafted into the Army, and he became a private and an interpreter. I don't know if any of you have heard of Operation Husky. It's largely lost to history, unless you're a real World War II buff, but Operation Husky was the largest amphibious assault in military history. It was significantly bigger even than D-Day. It took place on July the 7th, 1943. Listen to these numbers. 2,600 vessels leave Northern Africa carrying 600 tanks, 8,000 trucks, 80,000 American, British, and Canadian soldiers. And my Uncle Tony is on one of those transport ships headed toward the southern coast of Sicily. He's wearing a helmet and he's diving beneath a truck because the Nazis have heard about this flotilla and they are flying overhead and they are dropping bombs in the Mediterranean Sea and their guys are shooting up all over. And Tony thinks he's going to die and he's praying to God to spare him. And he survived. The Allies took Sicily in just a few weeks. The Italians really didn't like Hitler and they didn't like Mussolini and they were quick to surrender. Tony was assigned to a Major Edgar Johnwick, and he went to a little hill town in southern Sicily called Kankakee, and he had a very important job. He was an interpreter for the restoration of that community, for putting that place back together, the government and the schools, the civil works, everything. Johnwick didn't speak a word of Italian, and so a local would come in and he would say something like, "Mi hanno detto che sarebbe partito settimana prossima." And Johnwick would say, Tony, get in here. What's he saying?" Tony would listen and he would turn that Italian into English just like that. So here's this high school dropout, this punk, in the middle of this great process of reorganizing this state, Sicily. He felt proud of himself. He loved his work. It was bracing. It was invigorating. And as he looked around, he realized something else. He loved Italy. He loved these Italians that were all around him. Here is this guy who had pushed aside his family heritage, pushed aside his family pride, only asked marginally about maybe having relatives back in Italy, seeing all these wonderful Italians, these Sicilians, friendly and funny. He remembers one morning hearing a commotion out in the alley. Somebody was yelling, "Latte, latte," and he pushes open the shutters and he looks down in the alley and he sees a farmer pulling a goat and a cow on a couple of ropes, and he's thinking, "What is going on here?" And a little old lady walks out into the alley with two empty jars, and the farmer milks that goat and that cow right there, fresh milk. The Italian boys in town, and they would come up to the apartment where Tony lived, and they would call for him to come out and walk with them in the gorgeous evening ritual called the passeggiata, and he would link arms with them, tipping his head back to sing these Italian folk songs, which they had taught him. They would stagger like drunks and laugh their heads off. Tony loved these guys. He couldn't believe that just a few months earlier, they were the enemy. And the more he absorbed this Italian nature and culture and goodness, the more he thought, I'm from here. I'm Italian too. I have family here. I have an aunt in Calabria. I've got to find her. Now remember, I told you that Tony was charming. He's handsome. One morning he's having breakfast with a friend named Giordano from New Jersey. And he says to Giordano, where are your people from? And Giordano says, Calabria. And Tony says, yeah, mine too. Let's go find them. And Giordano says, great. Do you have a pass? And Tony says, don't worry about that. Tony was friends with the guy back in the garage that kept the Jeeps. And so he told him a few jokes, slipped him a few lira. And before you know it, Tony's got a Jeep. He's got plenty of gas. They're in their khaki uniforms. And they are driving across the northern coast of Sicily, AWOL, in search of relatives. Now, Giordano knows exactly where his aunt lives. She lives in a little village called Via San Giovanni. They go straight to it. They drive to her door, and you would think that these people were waiting for him. They pour out of the house, screaming and yelling and crying, pounding this guy on the back like he's a conquering king or something. And Tony sees this commotion. He can't believe it. He feels excited, and he feels envious. He grabs Giordano, and he says, listen, you found your aunt. Now, I'm going to find mine. I'll come back to get you in 4 days. And it's just a small problem. Tony has no idea where his aunt lives. Like, Calabria is like the size of New Jersey, right? And Tony starts driving around, looking. He goes down to the big city of Reggio Calabria. This is a needle in a haystack search. There are 100,000 people that live there. Tony has no idea that there are Catanosos all over the place, relatives of his. He doesn't know they live there. He doesn't know where they live. He doesn't know how to find them. He doesn't know that there is a priest at the seminary who one day is going to be named a saint. He doesn't know that either. He's just looking around, waiting to get lucky. And it's not happening. He gets hungry. It's getting dark. It's starting to rain. He sees the lights of what he remembered being a friendly trattoria. He's wearing his khaki army uniform. He walks into this family restaurant. It's packed. He takes a seat in the middle of this restaurant. The place gets quiet. Everybody's staring at him. The waiter comes up to him and says, soldier, what are you doing here? And Tony says, I don't know. I'm looking for my aunt, but I don't think I'm going to find her. And the waiter says, I don't know, maybe there's somebody here who can help you. And he motions to this little old guy in the back. He's wearing a jacket and a vest, a sharply knotted tie. He comes forward, he sits down at the table with my Uncle Tony. His name is Alfredo Smorto. And he says to Tony, he says, soldier, where are you from? And Tony's thinking to himself, well, I'm from Wildwood, but he's not going to have heard of Wildwood. So I'll just tell him Philadelphia. And so he does. And Smorto says, ah, Philadelphia, you must know my brother. And Tony says, no, your brother, there are a million people in Philadelphia. How am I going to know your brother? And Smorto says, yeah, my brother, Silvio Smorto. Tony sits up in his chair. He feels a little tingle go down his back. He says, Silvio Smorto, you mean Sam? You mean the guy that owns the real estate office at 9th and Mifflin? Yeah, that's my brother. Tony says, that's my dad's best friend. That's my godfather. Well, Smorto, he slams his hands on the table. He jumps out of his chair. He grabs Tony by the lapels. He pulls him to his feet. He kisses him on both cheeks. He turns to the crowd in the restaurant and he says, this American soldier is family. And the whole place erupts. They go wild. They're cheering and crying. They come around Tony. They're banging on the back as if he alone had just liberated Italy. It was remarkable. But it's not why Tony was there. And he grabs Smorto and he says to him, look, this is great, but I'm really looking for my aunt. You don't happen to know Maria, do you, Maria Catanoso? Now, here's the thing about Smorto. See, this is where the story gets a little funny. Like, I don't know whether this guy's lucky, whether he's on a roll, or whether he is sort of a future divine intercessor for a saint to be named later. But he looks at my Uncle Tony with this twinkle, and he says, "You mean Maria Porzia Cadenoso? Of course I know her. She's from my village. I'll take you there tomorrow." So the next morning, Tony wakes up. He stayed in some military compound. The Jeep is parked out front, and he looks outside, and there's Smorto sitting in the front seat of the Jeep waiting for him. He goes out, and they take this drive up into the mountains, the lower Aspromonte. It should have taken maybe an hour and a half. It took well over 2 hours, because every time Smorto saw a shepherd or a goat herder, he would make Tony stop the Jeep, and he would stand up, and he would yell, "Come meet my American cousin!" So they get up into Curio, and as they're getting closer, Tony, he starts to tingle. He's getting a kind of an odd sensation. This is the place that his father had left, never to return. And he was going back. Now, Smorto wasn't so good that he knew exactly where Marie lived, and so he had to go to the main piazza in the middle of the little village and ask for directions. And what that did was just send a buzz around the place. I mean, Tony was the only American soldier ever to set foot in this place. And again, he's dressed in his khaki uniform. And then people come out of their houses. And now there's a big crowd in this piazza. And Smorto has directions. He knows exactly where to go. He takes a right. He starts walking down this alley. And it's like walking back in time. I've been down that alley, and it's a really cool feeling to do this. It was a short walk, maybe 3 or 4 blocks, and it opened up into a small piazza. And Smorto walked straight across that piazza to a 3-story block and stone home. Behind him is Tony and all these villagers. This is a parade. And they fill in the space. And Smorto stands under a 2nd-story window, and he calls up. He calls up and he says, "Maria, Maria Porzia, there's an American soldier here to see you." And she calls down for everybody to hear, "Go away." "I don't know any American soldiers." And Smorto, he waits for the crowd noise to die down, and he says, No, you know this one." And the next thing my Uncle Tony hears are his aunt's footsteps coming down the stairs. And she opens the door, and he sees her. But more to the point, she sees him. She had not seen her beloved brother Carmelo in more than 40 years. She never thought she would see him again. And there in the body of this handsome young American soldier was the spitting image of her brother. And she collapses into his arms. And my Uncle Tony can feel her tears against his cheek. Now you can imagine the commotion, the cheering and the crying, the clapping, the celebrating. Tony was not a letter writer. You may not be surprised to hear that. But he wrote a long letter home to his mother describing all this that happened to him. He said, it was as if everybody in town was a relative. And they had carried him into the house, and he looked around, and they were asking about Carmelo, and they were asking about Giuseppe and the parents, and they knew so much about them. And he wrote in the letter, "Mama, I never knew we had so many relations." It was a remarkable reunion. It was a sensational reunion. It was cinematic. I don't know if Frank Capra could have done it any better. And when my Uncle Tony tells me the story, he still gets tears in his eyes. And I say to him, "Uncle Tony, what do you make of all that?" And he doesn't hesitate. He says, "It was a miracle. It was the first miracle of Padre Gaetano Cadenoso." Now, there's just one problem with that. I know what miracles are, and I know what they aren't. I have studied them. I've been to the Vatican. I've talked to those saint makers. They would not agree with my Uncle Tony. What do they know? When I think of how my Uncle Tony stepped across the bridge of time, not just an ocean, to reconnect a family that had been torn asunder by immigration and war, how he had tied it all back up together, in many ways, how he had blazed a path for me to follow 60 years later, I know that what my Uncle Tony says is true. It was a miracle. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, I think half of us here are in tears, too, as you're...
That was the plan.
So, well, then, I'll begin with a question that you may be particularly well-suited to answer. Is the Pope Catholic?
Seriously? Yes. He's no longer Italian, but he is Catholic.
How has your own family benefited from what you learned about your lineage?
First, let me say we've benefited a lot. As a kid growing up, I did not get that pride in family. I did not develop a pride in my Italian heritage because I had the same sort of reticence about it as my father did. You know, I got teased the same way that they did as kids. And all the media about Italians is typically not very good, whether you think about The Godfather or you think about The Sopranos or this great new show on MTV now. And so you distance yourself from it. But to go back to Italy and meet relatives and to see what they're about and to see them in the context of that country and to realize and recognize that Italians, Southern Italians in particular, really wrote the book on generosity. And family warmth and love, the unconditional love, is to feel a renaissance of pride that was instant for me and overshadowed everything that had come before it in my 45 years. And for my daughters, who are now 21, 19, and 16, but at the time were 6 years younger, they got that pride early. They are proud to be Italian-Americans, and they know they have relatives there. And that's a huge impact. Huge.
After the discovery of a saint in your family, how was your faith affected?
That's a big part of the story. It was initially skepticism. I'm a journalist. Being skeptical and asking questions and sort of not taking things on faith is what we were taught here at Penn State. I had this epiphany, though, on the day of the canonization. We had missed the beatification. That took place in May of 1997. Gaetano Cardenoso was beatified in this extraordinarily elegant and dramatic ceremony led by Pope John Paul II in St. Peter's Basilica, St. Peter's Square. All the Cardenosos from Italy were there. None of the Cardenosos from America knew what was happening. But we were there for the canonization in October of 2005, all of us. My parents, my brother and sister. Marcella was there with her sister and her mother, traveling for the first time without my brother Alan. Scores of cousins and aunts and uncles. You sit there in the middle of St. Peter's Square, surrounded by that colonnade that Bernini designed, with 140 saints carved in travertine all around the edge. Those of you that have been in that square know what I'm talking about. And that beautiful basilica is in front of you with Michelangelo's dome on top. And the Pope is leading this thing. And sort of in that moment, you know what? Like, skepticism kind of goes away. You start to think that maybe you don't know more than the people that are there. And I told myself that if I was going to learn more about this saint, and I desperately wanted to, and this was even before I knew I was going to have an opportunity to write the book, I was going to have to open up myself to a Catholicism that I had let slide 25 years earlier without really a whole lot of thought. And I did. I worked at it very, very hard and immersed myself in all things Catholic for a long time. I joined a church. I had some priests that were great mentors for me. And it really made a difference. This is not a story of a great conversion at the end. It's very candid and very honest about as far as I can get. But it made a palpable difference in my spiritual life.
Did your brother's death, despite all the prayers, shake your faith?
Absolutely. But there's something else about it. You know, it made me think more deeply about what answered prayers might be. And I got to see this while I was doing my research in Italy. It was the summer of 2006, and I was there for the better part of a month with these relatives. The family patriarch was a man named Piero Catanoso, 65 years old. He was an attorney. He was the head of the Bar Association in Reggio Calabria. On a Saturday evening, I had been invited to make a talk at the church in that little village where my grandfather and the saint was from. It was an extraordinary evening. And Piero would come up from the city with his wife and kids and lots of other relatives to be a part of that. And I had another week left there, and he and I promised that night that I was going to be able to meet with him with an interpreter to interview him, as I was interviewing so many other relatives. He died the next morning of a heart attack. Suddenly, no warning. He dropped dead. And the whole vantage point perspective of my research was turned on its head. Everything stopped. And I thought I had to come home. I thought that, you know, sort of fun and games to be there doing this research. But now, he was the patriarch. I mean, the family was just devastated. And instead of leaving, I stayed, and I became a part of the mourning. And was there in the apartment when they brought the body back. And Gaetano's nuns that are still working there all rushed to the house to pray at the foot of his casket. And I got to see the resiliency that this family drew from the saint. And they accepted his death, as pained as they were, as agonizing as it was. And they believed that Gaetano was waiting. He was waiting to help him cross over. It was a beautiful thought. And I remember thinking in my idiotic American head that what good is having a saint in the family if he can't protect Piero from sudden death? And my relatives just sort of disavowed me of that. Those aren't the prayers that Gaetano's answering. That's still kind of hard for me to get. But there, at a certain level, a certain aspect, it makes sense. And I do think that there were prayers that were answered in regards to my brother, even though he did not get the miracle that we were praying for.
Based on your personal journey, what advice do you give your own children about life?
You can't give your kids advice. So that's the first thing. I mean, they don't listen to me. All right, I'll answer this. I mean, I think what Laurel and I both do is we try to lead by example. We continue to pursue our dreams. We continue to have dreams, and try to make a difference in the world and the things that we do. My wife is a singer and a songwriter and an amazing singer and songwriter. She gives a lot back to the community and to North Carolina and to the Southeast. And I'm sort of this writer, you know. And we have been modeling that for our kids. And we hope that they will take from that and chase their own dreams.
Well, then this is a bit of a follow-up. Any ideas for your next book?
This was a question that I really hated, like right after my first book came out, because it's like, I just finished. Can I just sort of revel in this for a day or two? But I actually have an answer to that. I do have an idea. I don't have a contract yet, but I'm actually working on it. It's not about saints or Italy or spirituality. One spiritual memoir is enough for me. If I get an opportunity to do it, it will be a book about science and business and a remarkable pharmaceutical company back in Winston-Salem that is in the process of taking its knowledge of nicotine, because this company actually started as a research division within a tobacco company inside Reynolds Tobacco, and they are now on the cusp of trying to treat some of our most heinous untreated illnesses: Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, ADHD, schizophrenia, and depression. And they are doing it based on their knowledge of nicotine, which is a terrible drug that hooks people and kills them early. And so this is a story about nicotine's redemption. And I'm really hoping I get a chance to tell that, but that's kind of what I'm doing now.
For those who would love to write a book but don't write for a living, what advice do you offer?
uh, get a commentary on NPR. you have to write. You have to love to write, and you have to write all the time. When I was a kid, I wrote letters long before email, and I sort of used it as practice. When I was here, I wrote more stories for the Collegian than I ever sort of wrote for classes. I mean, that was sort of my priority, was writing those news stories and columns for the Daily Collegian. You have to love to write, and you've got to write all the time, and you've got to believe in the story. And after that, you've got to be lucky and not give up. I was lucky to have an agent come to me. But if you have a good story and you believe in it and you're able to tell it well, you'll get your chance. And we have so many mediums now. If you don't get a big publisher, you know, you can publish it yourself. You can put it online. You can have a blog. I mean, there really are a lot of ways for writers to be rewarded for their creativity.
Do you have any suggestions for researching one's family history?
Well, you know, there wasn't a lot of genealogy with what I did. I really went back to primary sources in that sense that I was interested in connecting with living relatives. I did do some research that was given to me in Italian, and I had to have translators sort of turn that into English. Ellis Island has a great website where I learned the details of both of my grandparents in terms of when they came over, the ship that they came over on, who they traveled with, how big that ship was, things like that. So you can get those pictures. But Piero and I were actually supposed to do the court research. We were supposed to go to the courthouse and go through all those family records, and he died before we got a chance to do that. That's possible to do, but if you don't speak the language, it's hard. So connecting with relatives in another country is really a great thing and kind of a way of shortcutting it if you're lucky enough to be able to do that.
Has having a saint in the family changed your day-to-day behavior at all?
I don't think so. No. I think a little. I think it's made me a little bit more thoughtful. I hope this doesn't sound awful, but you get farther away. Like, my book came out a couple years ago, and you sort of get farther away, you get turned in, you know, another direction. When I was living in the middle of this story, which I did, you know, for over a year, I mean, I just thought about him all the time. And I would really think, you know, how would he handle this? And there are elements of that where I really think, what would Gaetano do? He really has been. And the thing with saints, and those of you that aren't Catholics, like, the church names saints to be role models, to be reminders of what it is to lead a faithful life. Not really to sort of answer prayers and deliver miracles. I mean, that's sort of secondary. And he was an extraordinary role model. He wasn't flashy. He wasn't an intellect. He didn't write great tomes. He just lived a life of heroic virtue and a life of service to the poor that was exemplary. And he made decisions about other people all the time and in an effort to alleviate their suffering. And that's kind of a high bar to measure up to. And I don't. But I do keep a mental image of him in my head.
You've written about the influence of your fifth grade teacher. Can you tell us some more about her?
Yeah, her name was Catherine McPherson. She died just a couple years ago at the age of 102. She was old when I had her in class, you know, like in 1971, you know, I was 10. And this is true. I mean, I really did have amazing teachers here that influenced me in very profound ways for the rest of my life. But Catherine McPherson was the first. Like, the things that I love the most and keep up with, like American history and birding and writing, started when I was 10, and they started in that fifth grade class because she loved those things. And she instilled that passion in me for those things. And she had these writing assignments that I just loved to do, and I got this great feedback from her, and that was really important. And the other flip side of this is that my father had family businesses that I just didn't want anything to do with. So I really started planning an escape, you know, at an early age, because I knew to get away from an Italian family business, you better have a plan. So I had a good plan. I'm going to become a journalist making $200 a week at the CDT. Like, my dad paid me twice as much to clean restrooms at his campground. But I wanted to be a writer, and I've never regretted that decision, except maybe a couple times.
As a newspaperman, what is your opinion of the injection of religion into politics?
That's a political question. I don't want to go on a rant, but I think it's terrible. I just think it's terrible. I just think it's it just doesn't have a place in politics. I think it excuses everything, and we make bad decisions as a result of it, and it just holds thing up, I mean, are we not going to have health care reform because we've got a handful of people that are just adamant about how they feel about abortion, which is a terrible issue, and we all have different opinions on that, but is that going to hold up health care reform? It's just like, can we set that aside? I said I wasn't going to rant. I think that it has no place, but it obviously will, and it is getting more intense as we go on.
Do you read books such as The Da Vinci Code, and what do you think of their take on the Catholic religion?
I did read The Da Vinci Code, and I was a page turner. I read it quickly, and I'm not a fast reader. I think that the Catholic Church really opens itself up to a lot of criticism that it gets, and I don't even think that I'm like stretching it to say that they deserve a lot of the criticism that they get. And so they're a big target. They've been an enormous power for a long time. We've had corrupt popes for years. We've had awful policies for years. And at that top level, that level of the church is the thing that keeps people like me from going back. And the cool thing about this process for me was that I joined a church, and it wasn't about any of that stuff. It wasn't about what the Pope was saying or doing. It wasn't about whether women could become ordained. It wasn't about birth control, all these incendiary issues. It really was about service to community. And it really was about what can we learn about the life of Christ that is applicable to our everyday life. And that, like, how do you argue with that? I want to make just a small point here. I've gotten lots of emails from readers with this book over the years. And I was telling a friend of mine this story last night. I got an email from a scientist who is at Rutgers University. And in the book, I described myself as a mediocre Catholic. And he congratulated me on being a mediocre Catholic. And I thought that was an odd thing to do until he said, if we had more mediocre people of faith in the world, it would be a much less violent place. And I just thought, hear, hear for mediocrity.
Did the teasing of your family take away the Italian language?
Absolutely. For my parents, absolutely. They could understand Italian, but they never learned to speak it, except for Tony. And it really did save Tony's life. Tony really would have been on the front lines and probably wouldn't have survived World War II. But they were deeply embarrassed by it. They really did turn away. I didn't know Carmelo because he died long before I was born. I knew my mother's father, who I'm named for. His name was Giustino. He was a gruff old guy, and even he, like the whole, this was hard for me to understand at the time, but when I was a kid, I bought him for Christmas a picture book of Italy, and you know, the famous tourist places, and he opened it up, and he paged through it, and he handed it back to me, and he said, what do I want with this? And at the time, I just thought that Gus was being difficult, but I realized that he had left an awful place, that those weren't pleasant memories that he had. And it was more important for him to be an American. And they sort of sent that down to their kids who were the first generation. And me as a second generation got very little of it beyond really the food rituals that, of course, we had. My mother was a great cook. And a little bit of the religion, you know, but even that was starting to dilute by the second generation.
Well, we have time for just one more question, but first I'm going to join you.
Okay.
And on behalf of the Penn State Forum and the Penn State Bookstore, I'd like to present you with this, along with our deep appreciation for sharing your story.
This is great. I'm coming back.
We don't think you're mediocre at all. And we also have a Penn State mug for you, but since you're flying, we will have that sent to you. And as someone whose cup obviously runneth over, we're sure you'll have great need for that. And now for one final question. As an undergraduate journalism student at Penn State, you had a job interview with the illustrious, if stodgy, New York Times. The interviewer, national editor Dave Jones, who is now a Penn State trustee, was known at the Times as, shall we say, no nonsense. Is it true that you arrived for your interview dressed in a blazer, button-down shirt, club tie, nice slacks, and a pair of flip-flops? And if so, how did that interview go?
I don't have any recollection of that interview. And obviously did not work for the New York Times. I honestly don't remember how that went. It didn't go very well, but I will tell you that when I was a student here, Dr. Oswald was the president. And he was at the end of a long tenure, and he wasn't very visible on campus, certainly not the way Dr. Spanier is around here. This is really the first time I've been back to Penn State where I haven't seen Dr. Spanier somewhere, like running into him somewhere on campus or here at the Nittany Lion Inn. But John Oswald was a bit of a recluse toward the end of his career here. And as a reporter for the Collegian, I was asked if I would be interested in interviewing him in his office in Old Main. And of course, I took that opportunity. And the guy that invited me said, you know, make sure you wear a tie. But I think I went in that same outfit. I really did. I was like, well, he said tie. He didn't say anything about shoes. And it was a fascinating interview, and Dr. Oswald was delightful and had this incredible insight, and it made me wish that he had been a little bit more visible at the end of his career. He did a lot of really remarkable things here.
Thank you very much.